the bloodiest war of the 19th century was one you may not have heard of. From 1850 to 1864, China was engulfed by the Taiping Rebellion, a civil war pitting the Qing Dynasty emperor against the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, a strange new movement led by a man named Hong Xiuquan. Previously unheard of atrocities were committed on both sides. By the time the dust settled and the Qing Empire restored order, nearly 30 million people were killed, a death toll that may have been the largest ever from a single war up to that point. At the time, over the whole course of human history, only Genghis Khan's conquests and the Three Kingdoms era, a long period of instability far back in China's past, could compare to it. And those both, arguably, consisted of multiple distinct wars. To this day, the only individual conflict historians are sure exceeded the Taiping Rebellion was World War II. To people just learning about it now, Taiping Heavenly Kingdom sounds like an appropriately Chinese name for a movement, right? They used to talk about heaven a fair amount over there, right? Didn't the emperor have something called the Mandate of Heaven? Well, sort of. China scholars in the West these days don't really like the Mandate of Heaven translation. It was a translation made by Christian missionaries in the 19th century because the Chinese word tian means the sky and has connotations of a spiritual, cosmic concept of the sky, so heaven, right? But it's not quite like the Christian concept of heaven. It's not where you go when you die, and it's not where God or gods live. I had a professor who preferred to translate it as Mandate of the Cosmos. The Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, meanwhile, everyone agrees that's the right translation. They meant the Christian concept of heaven because they were Christians, or claimed to be. Now, Christianity is full of sects. Who am I to say who's a Christian and who's not? But the Taiping made the Mormons look like dull mainline Protestants. They were non-Trinitarian, believing that Jesus wasn't literally God, which isn't totally unheard of for a Christian sect, but they also believed Jesus didn't have any supernatural powers and didn't do any of the miracles he was credited with, which is very rare for any flavor of Christianity. You could sort of say they were like Jeffersonian Christians, except Jeffersonian Christianity is explicitly against there being any supernatural elements, whereas they believed that you could do miracles, just Jesus didn't. They read an edited version of the Bible that included prohibitions on alcohol and classical Chinese philosophy. Instead of just God and Jesus, they worshipped a whole holy family, including God's wife, the Heavenly Mother, and Hong Xiuquan himself, who was said to be the younger brother of Jesus. And Mao, writing a century later, saw them first and foremost as proto-communists. Now, this episode isn't really about the Taiping Rebellion. It's not really about the man behind it, Hong Xiuquan, either. It's about the man behind the man, the Tennessee farm boy who showed up in China, taught the gospel to another lost soul, moved on to another city, and then years later, through no fault of his own, 30 million people died. This is the story of Issachar Jacobs Roberts. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Issachar Jacobs Roberts was born in Sumner County, Tennessee, northeast of Nashville, on February 17, 1802. I don't know where that middle name comes from. Issachar was one of the 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament, so presumably he came from pretty religious stock, but I've certainly never met a Jacobs, and that really might just be a misspelling of Jacob. In that time and place, it's conceivable that his family was illiterate, even if they did know their Bible well. As for young Issachar's formal education, he studied at the Baptist school known as Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, but was expelled for erratic behavior and was known for, quote, falling into difficulties with nearly everyone who worked with him. Some sources say he finished and got ordained as a Baptist minister nonetheless, others say he didn't. I think he just said he was ordained and ignored the paperwork requirement. He first set up a Baptist ministry in Edgefield, South Carolina, and then preached across the South. From the start, seeing the world seemed to be Robert's main goal in going into preaching, and he specifically wanted to go to China from early on. He sought to gain sponsorship to a missionary society so that he could be sent on the China Mission Society. However, the ministerial committee rejected Robert, citing that he lacked any basic education qualifications, had poor preaching skills, and was a, quote, difficult character. But did that stop Roberts from attaining his dreams? No, it did not. Roberts worked as a Baptist preacher and land speculator to save up enough money from real estate to go to China as an independent Baptist missionary. Despite having no knowledge of Chinese nor religious institutional backing, he got himself on a slow boat to China in 1837. I would really love to know Robert's route to China. At this point, people were still risking their lives going west on the Oregon Trail, so he probably didn't go to the west coast and across the Pacific. Looking at the trade routes of the time, I think he probably went across the Atlantic to Europe, then from there down around the tip of Africa and across the Indian Ocean to China. I think that especially makes sense because of the one stop he made that we know about. He stopped in Java in Indonesia, then controlled by the Dutch. He acquired a Chinese translated gospel while he was in Indonesia. He also took the name Luo Xiaojuan, no record on who named him that or if he'd already taught himself enough Chinese on the voyage to give himself that name. Robert spent 5 years preaching at a leper colony in Macau, a small Portuguese territory near Hong Kong. His fellow missionaries described him as zealous and pious. In order to stay preaching in Macau, he associated himself with the Boston-based Foreign Mission Board of the Baptist Triennial Convention, though he eventually ran afoul with the ministerial board, seemingly for being a gung-ho adventurer first and a preacher second, and departed to preach in Hong Kong. Roberts became the first Christian missionary to live outside the foreign-designated enclave in Guangzhou near Hong Kong, which was known as the Factory Zone. When he worked with other missionary organizations across the Guangdong area, he made up his own Baptist missionary organization called the Southern Baptist Board, which allowed him to get resources from foreign businesses in the area to build his own chapel and mission house. It was in 1847 that Robert's life would change forever. Not that he would have known that at the time, when he encountered Hong Xiuquan, a man who seemed at first to come across as any other Chinese lost soul Roberts had been talking to for years. Let's do a little detour to talk about Hong Xiuquan. Hong Xiuquan was born Hong Huoxiu on January 1, 1814, same birthday as Ice Spice, in Guangdong, southern China. Okay, Ice Spice was not born in 1814. He was the third and youngest son of a family of farmers. They belonged to the Hakka ethnic minority, a subgroup of the Han Chinese. The imperial Qing dynasty in charge of China at the time was run by another ethnic minority, the Manchu from the far northeast. And the Hakka, living at the opposite end of the country and strongly identifying with their Han roots, often formed some of the strongest opposition to the Qing. The Hakka were discriminated against in two separate directions, though, too. The reason they identified so strongly with their Han roots was largely to prove to the non-Hakka residents of Guangdong that they were Han at all. They had some culturally distinct features from the rest of the Han, notably being strongly against foot binding, the constriction of women's feet until they couldn't walk anymore. Having bound feet was the norm for upper-class women, and the Hakka were willingly shutting themselves off from some channels of power by not practicing foot binding. That got the Han to see the Hakka as a bunch of perverts with overly empowered women. Also, since the Hakka migrated from central China down to the south relatively recently in terms of the grand scope of Chinese history, they arrived there when most of the farmland was already being cultivated, leading them to become merchants and military officers at a much higher rate than the rest of the population. The Hakka came to occupy a social niche at the time, a bit like Jews in medieval Europe. There's strong official discrimination against them that puts them off limits to most of society and forces them into a few specific lines of work, but because of those specific lines of work, they're on average wealthier, more educated, and occupy more positions of power than your ordinary Joe. And that's the number one recipe for resentment. Hong Xiuquan's family was not wealthy or powerful. They were farmers. Xiuquan, known then as Huoxiu, was clearly the family's bright kid. He attempted many times to pass the civil service exams that were one of the only ways one could advance in imperial Chinese society from a peasant to the aristocracy. These exams were based on a person's knowledge of ancient Confucian philosophy and poetry and how to apply them to current government issues. They had to be extremely formulaic, with what's known as an eight-legged essay being the gold standard for centuries. It was common that only 1% of test takers pass. Hong Hoxiu made 3 attempts, which was the typical point at which it was considered wise to give up. You could try again, but not a lot of people did. 3 strikes, you're out. Because of his multiple failures, Hong had a total nervous breakdown and said he had visions from God. Here's an 1857 account of Hong's breakdown. Hong is then introduced to his heavenly mother, who cleanses him in the river so that he may be taken back to meet his heavenly father. Hong's father is tall, wears a black robe, and has a long golden beard that reaches his abdomen. Heavenly Father says, "All the human beings in the world are created and sustained by me. Not one of them all remembers and venerates me. They even take of my gifts and pervert them to the worship of demons. They purposely rebel against me and arouse my anger. Imitate them not." When the aged lord of the palace had finished this speech, he gave Xiuquan a sword, telling him to exterminate the demons with it, also a seal, which should give him power over evil spirits. His heavenly father tells him of the harm done by the demon devils and gives Hong permission to do battle with them in heaven. Hong was approached by a person of middle age, whom he called his elder brother. The elder brother instructed Hong to "Behold the people in yonder world. They are wicked in all the thoughts of their hearts." Thereupon, Xiuquan, looking over the face of the earth, saw that it was indeed full of wickedness, and his eyes not being able to endure the sight of so much iniquity, he awoke from his trance. Interestingly, this was not originally a Christian vision. Hong didn't see it that way when he first had the vision. He was only loosely aware of Christianity. When he'd been in Guangzhou to take the civil service exam years ago, an evangelist had given him a tract called Good Words to Admonish the Age, written by Liang Fa, arguably the first native-born Chinese Christian evangelist in relatively recent history. Liang had studied the Bible under an American doctor and missionary named Peter Parker, which isn't super relevant, but I had to include that. Hong leafed through it and didn't find it too interesting at the time. Even for years after his vision, when Hong was a penniless tutor teaching other students how to pass the civil service exam, which none of them ever did, it didn't occur to him to try to find out the source of the vision. Eventually, he attempted the civil service exam a 4th time, failed again, and only then did he find his copy of Good Words to Admonish the Age and realized he'd been visited by the Christian God. That guy, calling himself Hong's elder brother, he was Jesus. But what did this mean? Hong had to find another Christian and figure it out. He went to Guangzhou and found Issachar Jacobs Roberts. Hong studied under Roberts for over 3 months to gain further education on Christianity and the pamphlets he had previously received. Roberts stated in his own accounts that he found Hong's visions extraordinary. The church committee denied Hong's application to be baptized because Hong, quote, had no employment or pecuniary emolument, which Hong replied that he was poor, has no living, and if he joined the church, he would lose employment. The committee blocked his baptism. The reason you could be too poor to be baptized by Christian missions in China at the time was because of so-called rice Christians, people who converted just because the Christians were supplying free meals to the poor and didn't really care about following Jesus. Issachar Jacobs Roberts wanted to baptize everyone, whether they were rice Christians or not. Like, he was genuinely motivated by wanting to help the world, I think, but the church committee did not let him. So, with Roberts deciding, sorry man, them's the rules, and not baptizing Hong, Hong left Roberts to carry out his crusade to Christianize China. Despite not ever being officially baptized in the Christian faith, Hong still vowed to spread his vision of Christianity throughout China. Robert's response was mostly like, yeah, okay, have fun with that, but he did hope that Hong would be successful, much in the way you'd respond to an idealistic friend who says he wants to run for president. Roberts wrote to a friend in Nashville that there may be the commencement of outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon this benighted people. You gotta put yourself in Robert's shoes a little bit and realize that he believed he was being altruistic. Again, I think he was an earnest do-gooder who wanted to help the Chinese people, and since he literally believed anyone who didn't learn about Jesus would go to hell, that was the most helpful thing he could possibly do. He was saving souls. He had genuine empathy for the Chinese people, and that was his primary motivator. He definitely didn't want to impose any kind of Western secular power over China. He was horrified by the British attempts at getting them all addicted to opium. Maybe it's hard for the typical person who watches Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities to sympathize with his methods, but I definitely think Issachar Jacobs Roberts was an honest, altruistic, fundamentally good person. But Roberts stayed in Guangdong, ministering to the poor. It was not until 1852 that Roberts heard that Hong had created his own Christian kingdom, further up in the Chinese interior. Years went by where all he heard of his protege's conquests was rumor. Roberts wrote to friends and newspapers back in America, incredulously, hoping against hope that Christianity might really be coming to China, but with a definite undertone of uncertainty. If he is really acting conscientiously and doing the best he knows according to the scriptural instructions which he had received, doubtless good will result. The idolatry of this nation must come to an end. I must now pass this favorable opportunity here of alluding to the simple but beautiful assemblage of united instrumentalities, and this threefold instrumentality, foreign missionaries, native assistance, and Christian books, China will be revolutionized, and a great multitude saved through these means.
Good day, I am the brother of
Jesus Christ.
And it's time to overthrow the Qing and create heaven on earth, says some guy causing the deadliest civil war of all time.
After Hong left Reverend Robert's tutelage, he and an associate, who he'd already told about his vision, created the secret organization called Baishang Di Hui, God-worshipping society, and focused on converting people from the Hakka ethnic minority. It was a strange time to be Chinese, with the world bursting in. They'd lost the first opium war less than a decade ago, and China was forced to cede territory, notably Hong Kong, and open its borders to merchants. The centuries of seclusion were coming to an end. The century of humiliation was beginning. Being an ethnic minority in a time of rapid change is prime recruiting ground for a movement with strange ideas. Remember my previous episode? I was really not intending to make these as parallel as they are. Eventually, by 1851, just a couple of years after leaving Robert's tutelage, Hong's spiritual movement had amassed 60,000 followers and took control of the Qing city of Yong'an. They called themselves the Taiping, the Great Peace, although the way I'd read it, I'd translate it as Too Much Peace, which I'm pretty sure is based on a modern interpretation of that character that wasn't its main meaning at the time, but it's weirdly accurate. Even though dynasties rose and fell throughout Chinese history, and the most famous Chinese historical novel begins with the lines, "The empire once united longs to divide, the empire once divided longs to unite," the Chinese political and social systems had been astoundingly stable for millennia. The meritocratic system of magistrates, the emperor and his concubines, the provinces with their borders, the civil service exam with its eight-legged essay, the mandate of heaven, or mandate of the cosmos as I prefer calling it, all those things had endured throughout the rise and fall of dynasties. Rebellions were not unheard of, but they usually were predicated on the belief that the current dynasty had lost the mandate of the cosmos. The Taiping wanted to move beyond concepts like the mandate of the cosmos. They may have been the first large-scale movement in China that really wanted to shake society's foundations. Too Much Peace, while it is a mistranslation of Taiping, is an oddly useful one. China had had too much peace, too much stability up to that point, or so they thought. Time for everything to be upended. By 19 March 1853, Hong had over 2 million followers to his brand of Christianity and seized the major city of Nanjing. Nanjing means southern capital. Hong renamed it Tianjin, heavenly capital. Hong declared himself Heavenly King or Taiping King. When he first took over Nanjing, he declared that everyone of Manchu descent, the ethnic minority that ran the Qing dynasty, as demons that had to be eradicated. It was estimated that over 40,000 Manchus were killed in the immediate takeover. In 1856, Reverend Roberts wrote to an American magazine, Putnam's Monthly Magazine of American Literature, describing how all of Hong's religious instructions came from him and his chapel, It was one of the first sources to report on the ongoing Taiping Rebellion in the West. Roberts hadn't met Hong Xiuquan since before the movement began, though. He'd never been inside Taiping-controlled territory, and beyond his public writings, his letters to old friends and fellow missionaries back in America displayed far more uncertainty with the authenticity of Hong's faith. Not long after that, there was a power struggle within the ranks of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, in which Yang Xiuqing, one of Hong Xiuquan's earliest followers, tried to wrest control away from Hong, and ended up being killed alongside thousands of his supporters. Perhaps this is what encouraged Hong to reconnect with someone he knew he could trust, the American missionary who'd taught him the Bible. Roberts had gone back to America twice in the late 1850s, but China was his home now. He still lived in the same place down in Guangdong. It wasn't hard to send for him. So, Roberts journeyed through China, to the heart of Taiping-controlled territory. Traveling overland up to the mighty Yangtze River, then down the Yangtze to Nanjing, it was a months-long voyage, through a patchwork of fighting and displacement, some territories loyal to the Qing, others to the Taiping. My buddy Nick Miller, who wrote most of this episode, points out that this journey feels very similar to Apocalypse Now, and I agree, with the fascinating extra twist that the cult leader deep in the interior knows the person who's traveling to find him. They were friends once, and before they meet, each of them earnestly believe that they're on each other's side. In October 1860, Roberts arrived in Nanjing, and he was instructed to kneel in front of the Heavenly King, but he refused, horrified to discover that the Taiping didn't resemble any form of Christianity he was familiar with. Hong asked him to convert to the Taiping faith and become its global messenger, offering him the position of Director of Foreign Affairs for the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. He also offered Roberts three wives. Roberts declined all the offers, but aided the Taiping government in interpretation and translation. Roberts would write to all the English newspapers in China to help bring trade and commerce to the Taiping Kingdom and get the British, American, and French governments to establish relations with them over the Qing government. Hong also allowed all foreign Christian missionaries free rein to travel across all Taiping territory. What was life like under Taiping rule? All personal possessions, monetary goods, and land were surrendered to the state and shared by all. Mass redistribution of land was carried out based on the amount of people in a family. Land was given regardless of gender. Everyone would manage the cultivated land as the goal would be to eradicate inequality. See why Mao saw the Taiping as proto-communists? The queue, the hairstyle with a single long braid in the back that's a stereotype of Chinese people even today, was banned. The queue was a Manchu tradition, and when the Qing dynasty first rose to power, most Chinese saw it as every bit as foreign as we would. They had forced all of China to wear a queue under penalty of death as a means of easily identifying would-be rebels. If you chafe under the requirement to change your hairstyle, you're more likely to rebel in important... If you chafe under the requirement to change your hairstyle, you're more likely to rebel in important ways, too. The Taiping banned the queue, which led to the rest of China nicknaming them long hairs. The imperial examinations would be based on the Bible instead of Confucian texts, albeit this was the Taiping Bible, which included some Confucian texts. Buddhist monasteries and Confucian libraries were burned. The lunar calendar was replaced with a solar calendar. Foot binding for women was banned. Women were allowed to take the civil service exams and serve in the Taiping military. The sexes, while equal, would be separated. No one would be allowed to have any sexual relations, as that leads to sin. I mean, not any. Sex within marriage was prohibited. Sex segregation was so zealously enforced that mothers couldn't communicate with their sons and fathers couldn't communicate with their daughters. All social contact between genders was banned. All of it. I'm not sure where the Taiping thought babies were supposed to come from. That law was eventually weakened for obvious reasons, but it really was seriously enforced for years. The death penalty was given for those found guilty of adultery or licentious behaviors. Those behaviors include casting amorous glances, having lustful thoughts, smoking opium, and singing libidinous songs. By 1862, Reverend Roberts realized the Taiping's version of Christianity was heretical. I don't know why it took him 2 years to realize this. The final straw that broke the camel's back for Roberts was how the Taiping treated one of Roberts' servants. We may never know the full story because the way Roberts told it varied over time, and he's the only source. The original story says that Roberts was shielding a young man who was wanted for a capital offense among the Taiping. Maybe he'd had consensual sex with a woman or something, and he was hiding the guy in plain sight by having him work as Roberts' servant. One night, though, Hong Rungan, who was the prime minister of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom and was Hong Qiuquan's cousin and had also been one of Roberts' Bible students in the years before the rebellion, entered Roberts' private chambers, made, quote, insulting remarks and gestures, and then murdered Roberts' servant with a sword. Or maybe he beat him to death. Or, in later versions of the story Roberts told, maybe he beat him, stabbed him, or both, but the guy survived either way. Also, maybe it wasn't Hong Rungan, maybe it was one of Rungan's assistants or a family member of his. Perhaps the striking original version of events was what happened, and Roberts sanitized the story to stay on the Taiping's good side in case they conquered all of China, which seemed like a legitimate prospect at the time. Or perhaps none of this happened, and Roberts simply made it up as his pretext to get the hell out of Dodge. Most likely the truth is somewhere in the middle. Either way, Roberts fled Nanjing on a ship, the British gunboat Renard, and never returned. Reverend Roberts wrote to the British government saying, "Hong was a crazy man, entirely unfit to rule without any organized government. He is violent in his temper and lets his wrath fall heavily upon his people, and ordering such instantly to be murdered without judge or jury. His religious toleration and multiplicity of chapels turn out to be a farce, of no avail in the spread of Christianity. Worse than useless." This was a turning point in the Taiping Rebellion. Previously neutral European powers began to intervene on the side of the Qing Dynasty, believing the weak and corrupt Qing to be easier to manipulate than the pious, bewildering Taiping. By 1864, the Taiping Rebellion began to collapse, and as the Qing Empire began besieging Nanjing, the followers were starving to death. Hong ordered his followers to eat manna, the food that sustained the Israelites for 40 years in the Book of Exodus. What is manna? These days, there's a misconception that manna refers to unleavened bread, like crackers, but I don't know where that comes from, because in the Bible, it's described in extensive detail that makes it clear it's not any kind of normal food. It's a strange supernatural food source that is gathered from the ground and looks similar to frost, is replenished overnight, melts in the heat, can be made into cakes that taste like oil, and rots quickly. There are so many oddly specific details about how manna is cultivated and prepared in the Book of Exodus that most historians think it must refer to something specific, but they're at a loss for what it could have been. The name itself, manna, is believed to come from the Hebrew for, what is it? Either way, manna was translated into Chinese as sweetened dew and medical herbs. The people ate weeds around the palace. On June 1st, 1864, Hong died of unclear causes. It may have been self-inflicted, he may have been killed by the Qing forces, or, it's possible, he accidentally poisoned himself by eating weeds. Either way, his death brought the rebellion to an end. The Qing destruction of the Taiping followers was horrific. The Qing dynasty ordered the execution of a million of them. As the Hakka ethnic minority were some of the earliest followers of the rebel movement, the government was executing 30,000 of them a day for their treason against the state. Zheng Guotran, imperial commander, stated, "Children and toddlers, some not even as old as toddlers, had been hacked or run through, just for sport." Hong's body was exhumed and beheaded. His remains were then shot out of a cannon to prevent his body from having an earthly home, thus condemning his spirit to becoming a restless ghost for all eternity. The secret ingredient, as it were, that allowed the Qing to finally crush the rebellion wasn't having foreign help, which was always paltry. It was the Tuan Lian system, which empowered local leaders to conscript people in their area to fight the rebels, a power previously only held by the emperor. Regional warlords didn't want to relinquish the power they'd gained once the rebellion had been suppressed. And the Tuan Lian set China on a one-way path toward greater decentralization and eventually the complete collapse of the empire. The end of a 3,000-year tradition. Roberts Baptist Missionary Board, back in the United States, when they became aware of his involvement in the creation of the Taiping Rebellion, dismissed him because his usefulness to the Christian cause was seriously questioned. After being dismissed by the Baptists, he did create his own periodical called The Oriental and Chinese Advocate, but he didn't spend too much time in China after being run out of Nanjing on a rail. He was seriously sick by this point. Ministering in that Macau leper colony all those years ago had finally infected him with leprosy, which is semi-contagious but spreads through a strange, slow process, little understood even to this day, sometimes with a decades-long incubation period. Roberts returned to the United States. He died of leprosy in 1871 in Upper Alton, Illinois, alone and forgotten by his family. His surviving descendants waived the claims to his estate. It's one thing to live your life being accused of something you didn't do. At least you know you're innocent, even if the rest of the world doesn't believe you. If you're a devout Christian like Roberts, you can tell yourself that God knows you're good. Reverend Roberts never got that closure. Did he ever do anything seriously wrong? It's not clear. You can, of course, argue that he shouldn't have been trying to Christianize China, but he wasn't trying to do it at the point of a sword. Life is random and cruel. For many of us, that's reason enough not to believe in God. One can only imagine what Issachar Jacob Roberts thought at the end of his own life. A life he'd spent devoting himself to saving souls in God's name. An honest man with nothing to show for it, but limbs dropping off, and 30 million dead Chinese. I can hope that he made peace with it, though, as best he can. He couldn't have known the effect he'd have. I don't know if there's a heaven, but if there is, I hope Issachar Jacob Roberts is there, despite being the midwife to one of the most tumultuous times on God's green earth.